Blog Talk Radio.
D&T After Dark.
Welcome, everybody. This is Dan T. After Dark, and I am Dawn. So today is Bratter Day. If you don't know what that is, it is a day of the week that is dedicated totally to Brad Tierney. Now, if you don't know Brad, then you don't know anything, because Brad is the best. He is the biggest supporter, cheerleader for the indie horror community ever. He writes the best reviews. He's always so excited. He keeps us hyped up. He keeps us going. He is a mainstay in the indie horror community, and everybody just loves Brad. He is he's just amazing. And so, well, he couldn't be here with us tonight, but I sent him over some interview questions, and he was so kind as to answer these for us. So let's see what Brad had to say. I asked him to tell us a little bit about himself, so here's what Brad had to say. Hey, everyone, it's me, VT. I'm a short, smarmy, tattooed fat guy with a big beard and a bad back, evil children, a mean Mormon wife, and three sweet, sweet little biscuit babies. Okay, so I'm in Maine, USA, and I love to read shitloads of horror, especially sick indie splatterpunk, which is my favorite, but I truly love every subgenre. You have to just know Brad. And I know I'm not doing it justice to how it would actually sound if it was him saying it, but we're just trying to celebrate him a little bit, so maybe you can get the gist of it anyway. So then I asked him, where did his love for horror start? And he said that his earliest horror memory is reading the Crestwood Monster series books in, like, the first or second grade. The old orange cover books, ever see those? I fell in love with those books. I had never seen the movies they portrayed, especially The Blob and The Wolfman. I can remember watching the old War of the Worlds late one night. I'm sure that experience kept the flame going. Another biggie was my first monster manual. Man, those were the days. I stopped reading when I had kids, couldn't commit the time or concentrate, you know. I hate them for that, fuckers. But anyhow, now that they're graduated and over 18, I have refocused on reading. I'm more addicted than ever before. He's kidding, y'all. Don't nobody get offended, okay? He loves his children. So what book got him started with indie horror? And he said that would be Tamer Animals by Justin M. Woodward. A friend had suggested it. I just shrugged and headed to Goodreads to do a bit of investigation. Somewhere on there, someone said Tamer Animals is the perfect combination of Texas Chainsaw and Stand By Me. Of course, I scoffed at such a lofty and outlandish claim, as I love Stand By Me and Texas Chainsaw more than anyone else on the planet. I immediately bought the book. No one can resist a carrot dangling like that. Well, it was indeed perfect. Epic, brutal, insane, humorous, and poignant, and I was immediately hooked. So I will go ahead and say I have never read Tamer Animals. I've seen it. They're posting about it, talking about it. I have not read it. So this is what Amazon says about Tamer Animals. It was just a camping trip down by the old Coheely Creek covered bridge. Four high school friends only wanted to kick back, smoke some weed, and forget about their problems for a day or two. Sure, there were stories that the area was haunted, but there was no way they were true. It was just a local legend. Decades earlier, an old goat farmer had been murdered by the Klan, hung from a tree near the bridge solely because of the color of his skin. His body was never found. Since then, numerous sightings of a strange creature, half man and half goat, had been reported in the surrounding woods. He was called the Goat Man. It was just the worst night of their lives. From the moment they arrived, strange noises echoed around them. A sense that they were being watched pervaded the campsite, and that was just the beginning. When one of them vanishes and a horned monstrosity pursues the others, it becomes clear that the legends are real, and the truth is so much more horrific than they could have ever imagined. Okay, okay. So that sounds pretty good. I might actually have to check that one out, Brad. The next question that I asked him was, what one book would he recommend that everyone read? He says, only one, Jesus Christ. Well, I would say Scapegoat by James Newman and Adam Howe is the pound-for-pound best horror experience I've ever had with a book. I mean, this book fucking rules. Have you read it, Dawn? Oh, yeah, you're not here. Oh. no, I actually own Scapegoat, but I have not read it. So, obviously, I'm very behind on the times, and I need to get on that, right? So what does Amazon say about Scapegoat? It says, March 29th, 1987, from Metalhead's Mike Lawson, Lonnie Devereaux, and Porkchop, an RV road trip to WrestleMania III becomes a one-way ticket to hell. While delivering an illegal shipment of counterfeit wrestling merchandise, an ill-fated shortcut through the Kentucky backwoods leads them to a teenage girl carved head-to-toe in arcane symbols. Soon, our unlikely heroes are being hunted through the boonies by a cult of religious crazies who make the Westboro Baptists look like fireboys, a cult that will stop at nothing to get the girl back in a complete ritual that has held an ancient evil at bay for centuries, until now. Okay, well, obviously, I need to get on reading that. I hate when I own a book, and I've had it, because I've had this at least since last year, if not before. And then you find out that it's really actually good, and you're wondering why you've never read it. Yeah. Okay. Favorite horror book and movie? He says his current champion horror book is The Night Stalkers by Christopher Triani and Ryan Harding. And his favorite horror movie is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, 74. Do you like Head Cheese? My brother makes it real good. You could have dinner with us. I do not like Head Cheese, but I do love Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I've been seeing a lot of buzz about the Night Stalkers, actually, and I have it in my Amazon cart, have not bought it. I'm a terrible, terrible person. I've got to get up with my reading here. So Amazon says about the Night Stalkers. Attention shoppers, the employees at the Freshway grocery store aren't too happy about having to do an overnight shift, but they're about to be even unhappier. Their rival store, Devil's Food, is about to lay siege upon them with extreme prejudice. This is no ordinary grocery chain. Devil's Food is run by a cult of murderous Satanists committed to killing the competition, literally. Armed with hatchets, knives, maces, and motorcycles, they enter the store and start picking off their victims in the most ghastly and depraved ways possible. The Freshway's only chance of survival is to fight, and this leads to a bloody battle royal of crazed cashiers, knife-wielding demo ladies, brutal butchers, and teenage clerks determined to make their favorite death metal album come true. Okay, well, I've heard a lot about that, and obviously I need to read that one as well. I'm just going to have to go ahead and hit that buy button. So the next thing I asked him, was there anything coming up in the indie world that he was looking forward to? And he said, well, I stay pretty much in a constant state of excitement when it comes to indie horror. I love the things godless.com is doing. Check out godless.com. Drew is amazing. Godless is amazing. You can get so many books on there. You can even get merch. They have audiobooks. You can get antique books on godless.com. So, yeah, go check that out. I'm a diehard Death's Head Press fan. I'm actually finding it quite difficult to keep up with the pacing of the amazing fucking tsunami of releases lately. There have been a lot of releases, but that's always a good thing because it always gives you something to do, something to look forward to, right? If you could smoke a bowl with any horror icon, who would it be and why? He says, oh, that's a tough one. Vincent Price. No way. Stephen King. Why? So I could constantly remind you that I texted to God and you didn't, and you would be totally jelly, and I would laugh and laugh. Yes, yes. Brad knows how much I love Stephen King, so of course he would do that so he could tell me all about it and rub it in my face. If you could listen to death metal with any indie horror person, who would it be and why? He says Jeremy Wagner from Broken Hope, who is also a sick indie horror author. It's like a two for one. That would rule. Be right back. I'm going to put on some Broken Hope right now. Okay, I'm not familiar with him as an author, and I'm also not familiar with Broken Hope, so I'm sucking at this. I'm going to have to get up with the Brad in the Brad Cool Gang, so I got to keep up with what's going on. What's your favorite thing to do while reading? He said eat sunflower seeds. I'm actually quite a dullard in real life, so I need total quiet and concentration in order to read and understand what the hell is going on. Even with comic books, my brain is broken. Don't worry, Brad. I'm the same way. If I'm reading in the bathtub, my bathroom is right next to my kids' room, one of my kids' room, and if they are in there playing a video game or talking, it's like, what I can't read what's on the page because I'm listening to what they're saying. So I totally understand. And then I asked him, do you have a ritual with reviewing books? How do you pick your next book? He says, oh, shit, now that's something I need to do, set up a ritual or method for my reviews. I've been sporadic at best because I suck. Who does not? I can read and then review immediately for like a month or two. Then I just conk out and read. And the reviews get backed up, and then I panic and shit my pants, and it sucks. He says, to pick my next read, well, I tried planning ahead once at the beta reading for someone. I just choose on a whim. He says that whim might take 6 hours of contemplation and examination of his collection, which is fucking huge. And I do not doubt that one. But, well, if you've seen his pictures that he posts sometimes, he shows all his books, and he does have quite a massive collection. So I can imagine that trying to actually pick one would be quite the daunting task. So since this podcast today is all about Brad, and I know how much he loves Texas Chainsaw Massacre, we're going to talk about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, I think almost everybody in the world knows what Texas Chainsaw Massacre is. You know, the movie with Leatherface. But it's I enjoy it quite a bit myself. So I have found 20 facts Chainsaw Massacre. So I'm going to try to go through these fairly quickly. But I love movie facts. I don't know if other people do that or not, but it may just be like a weird thing that I do. But I always like to go back, and especially if there are movies that I really enjoyed, go back and read, little tidbits or interesting things about them. I just think that's interesting or maybe super weird. I don't know. So Texas Chainsaw Massacre was filmed in the summer of 1973. And if you're not aware, it was shot in Central Texas, which was very, very hot. So actually, if you don't know this, it was actually inspired by a Christmas shopping crowd. I know that a lot of people say, you know, the inspiration of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was this and it was that, and they're surprisingly diverse. And, of course, I mean, you know, I've heard that it was a modern retelling of Hansel and Gretel, to a real-life Wisconsin murderer, and Corpse of Tyler Etke. I think everyone knows who he is. But actually, the director was out in a shopping for Christmas, and how it is at Christmas time. There's, you know, people everywhere. So these crowds are everywhere, and he is, you know, trying to figure out, you know, it's crazy. He's trying to get out of this store. Well, he ends up by a rack, a display rack of chainsaws, and he just kind of thought, oh, I know how I could get out of here really quick. Just take this chainsaw and kill all the people from here to the door, you know. So he says that he went home and that everything just, the whole story came to him, you know, it's right off the bat. So I thought that was really interesting. Now, again, like I said a while ago, Leatherface is allegedly based on Ed Gein. I've heard some other, you know, Norman Bates from Psycho. I've heard several different things. But it, he was, while Ed Gein might have had part of the making of Leatherface, it was actually a more direct way that it came to Hooper. He knew that he knew this doctor that had told him that when he was in a pre-med student that they were studying cadavers and that he went into the morgue and skinned this cadaver and he made a mask for Halloween. So that's when they decided that Leatherface would have a different human skin mask to fit each of his moves. So interesting. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre was not the original title. The first title that it actually had was Head Cheese, due to the scene where the hitchhiker actually details the process of how that particular pork product is made. And then it actually changed to the working title of Leatherface. But they ended up changing it because Hooper and another guy that was actually the head of the Texas Film Commission, he helped the project get financing. So they had suggested the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and so that's what they ended up going with. It is not a true story. Though the real crimes of Ed Gein, it did influence them for sure. But it being based on a true story, it grew out of the marketing from the film. Because if you notice, the opening narration promises that the film that which you're about to see is an account of the tragedy which befell a group of five youths. And then on the original poster, it says, what happened is true. and while this is all clever and everything, it is not a true story. It is a work of fiction. And Gunnar Hansen, that actually played Leatherface, said that he's had people come up to, he's passed away now. He said at the time he had had people actually come up to him and say that they knew the original Leatherface. So, now, the next one, Gunnar Hansen was not the original Leatherface. I know it's hard to imagine anybody but Gunnar Hansen. He passed away in 2015. Actually being Leatherface, but he was not the first person cast in the role. They said that he was told that he'd be great for the role, but it was already cast. And then the original Leatherface quit. So he called, they called him up 2 weeks later and, you know, just told him, look, this guy quit and we need you to come in and play Leatherface. And he went in and he was 6'4" and he weighed 300 pounds. And they said that Hooper gave him the role on site. So that's neat. Leatherface was inspired by real mental patients. Obviously, if you've ever seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre, then you know that Leatherface doesn't have any real dialogue. He, to drive his character, I mean, he has to use his facial expressions, which are obviously hidden by a mask. So when he wanted his character to squeal like a pig, Gunner actually went out to the country and studied one of his friend's pigs. And then, to capture the mental instability of the character, he went to the Austin Mental Hospital and studied the movements of the patients there so he could incorporate it into his performance. That is so super interesting. A lot of mental patients, if you're not familiar, I shouldn't say a lot, but some, are nonverbal. So a lot of them have very interesting facial expressions, body movements, and ways that they communicate with you. So that's very interesting to me that he was so involved in the character of Leatherface that he actually went and studied, you know, what to do to make it look more realistic. They actually really wanted a PG rating on Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And, you know, it has this huge reputation for gruesome mutilation and gore. But if you actually go back and look at it, much of the violence is suggested rather than directly depicted. And that was because he wanted a PG rating so that the film could reach a wider audience, because at that time there was no such thing as PG-13. And he was told by the Motion Picture Association of America that it could help his case if he limited the amount of on-screen blood. And so if you actually go back and watch it, there's actually probably only about 2 ounces of blood that you actually see. But the film's intensity ultimately meant it earned an R rating. So, now let's talk about the shooting of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was produced on a budget of $60,000, and that was raised by Bill Parsley, who was a Texas Tech Administrator and former member of the Texas Legislature. And he sort of fancied himself a film producer, but even in 1973, $60,000 was, I mean, that's a shoestring budget, y'all. John Carpenter's Halloween was made for 5 times that amount in, like, a few years later. Well, actually, 1978. So what that meant was they have got little pay and long hours. And to make matters even worse, they were in the Texas summer with temperatures in excess of 100 degrees. Air conditioning interior shots, so they're actually in the house. It was 115 degrees in there. There was a single bathroom that was shared by more than 3 dozen people. They had costumes that could not be changed because the actors only had one set of clothes. And the constant presence of the bones and rotting meat that they used as props. Almost no members of the cast went uninjured. And the heat and the stench got so bad at one point that the actors would run to the windows of the house where the dinner scene was shot to throw up and breathe a little fresh air between takes. Hooper actually sarcastically referred to the experience as an interesting summer. So now while we're talking about the dinner scene, you know, that's freaking brutal. Can you imagine being in 115 degree heat in clothes that you've worn for days? The smell is horrendous. And, I mean, no wonder they all look haggard and half crazy, and you know, I mean, they probably actually were. So the legendary dinner scene shot was actually shot in a single marathon day. It's near the end of the film where Sally, which was played by Marilyn Byrne, she's terrorized by Leatherface and his family, and it's one of the most intense sequences in all of horror cinema. I mean, it actually feels like you're watching a group of people go insane. And, I mean, maybe you are. Because in addition to the excessive heat and odor in the dining room during filming, it had to be completed in a single day because John Dugan, he was the actor who played Grandpa, he refused to endure the 10-hour process. So they, cast and crew, had to work for 27 hours straight to finish a scene that actually only takes up a few minutes of the film. So that's horrible. The cast actually disliked Franklin. Franklin, if you're not familiar, was Sally's wheelchair-bound brother. He makes people irritated because he grows angry with his more able-bodied friends because, you know, he can't share in their fun. So, Paul Partain is actually the guy that played Franklin, and he said that he was so immersed in the character that he would play not just him on screen, but even when he was off screen, he would be the same way, that whiny. They said that at one point that him and Sally Burns, which Marilyn Burns, she plays Sally, his sister, they actually stopped talking at one point. And Gunnar Hansen actually said that he was the only character that he was actually happy to kill. Leatherface's victims treated him as an outsider behind the scenes. So we already talked about the fact that Gunnar Hansen was 6'4" and he weighed 300 pounds. So he's working in triple digit heat. He's wearing a wool costume that he cannot change out of. He got so smelly by the end of production that the rest of the cast and crew would not eat around him. And so they would not hang around with him because they didn't want to, quote unquote, hang out with their killer. They would not talk to him or be anywhere near him until he actually killed them. So that's pretty funny that and they said that Jerry, that's played by Alan Danziger, he discovers Leatherface's slaughter room, and then he actually meets Leatherface, sees him for the first time. And the scream that he screams at the time is actually genuine because that was the first time he had seen Gunnar Hansen in full costume. Leatherface actually wears three different masks. Now, the reason behind that is they were the only way that he could truly express himself. So he has the plain killing mask that he wears for the majority of the film. Then he has the grandma mask that he wears when he's preparing the dinner and he's showing his. And then he had the cover, the makeup covered mask that he wears when he sits down to dinner, complete with a suit. And, of course, that was the Southern tradition of dressing up for the evening meal. So if you're wondering where that came from, so there's a scene in there where Sally, they cut her finger during the dinner scene. And they do that so that her, and basically what they were supposed to do was the knife blade that was used was dulled by a piece of tape, but it also held like a rubber tube that was attached to a bowl full of fake blood, obviously. And so when he dragged the knife across Burns' finger, Gunnar Hansen was supposed to squeeze the bulb and pump the blood out to simulate the cut, but the tube kept clogging after every take. And now you have to remember, this was during a 27-hour shooting marathon. So when nobody was looking, Hansen stripped the tape off the knife and cut her for real. He later said, at this point, I was so crazy that I just wanted to get the film over with. The saw that is used is real. The teeth on the show were Renee's for some shots. The saw that he wielded in the film was indeed a working chainsaw. And the blade of the saw was just inches from actor William Bell's head for the scene in which Leatherface begins carving up Kirk's body. And so Hooper and Pearl had to dance around Hanson to shoot the film's final moments as Leatherface is swinging the saw around. And so actually during the chase scene in which Leatherface is pursuing Sally through the woods at night, Gunnar Hanson actually slipped and fell. And the saw went flying into the darkness. And, of course, they had no idea where the power tool was going to land. And so they said that Hanson just covered his head and hoped for the best, and it landed just a few inches away. The cast actually did not get a share in the film's success. Now, we talked about already that the budget for Texas Chainsaw was only $60,000. So they took the cast of Chainsaw, actually took ownership shares in the film rather than a salary. But their shares were a percentage of Vortex, which was the company set up by Hinkle and Hooper to produce the film. And since Vortex only owned half the film, Parsley owned the other half, their shares were all sliced in half, which apparently a lot of them didn't realize at the time. So to make matters more complicated, Bryanston Distributors, they acquired the film for release in late 1974. They were declaring revenue for the film was much, much lower than the millions it raked in at the drive-ins and midnight shows. The producers eventually took Bryanston to court, but by then the distributor's financial situation was so dire that they had no assets to sue for. So, actually, the cast got very little money for their work, which is, oh my gosh, can you imagine? I'm going through all of that, and then you get literally no money. It has an alleged connection to the mafia. Bryanston, the company that we were just talking about that owned the shares for the movie, it was actually owned by Joe and Lou Pirino. And they were members of the Columbo crime family. And so that's the connection to the mafia. And they actually got into the film business in the first place because they muscled away the rights to another classic that you might have heard of. One cast member used to frighten moviegoers at screenings. So Ed Neal, which is actually the guy that played the hitchhiker, he would go to screenings that they had of the film at Austin Village Theater, and he would wait for his scenes to come up, and he would tap viewers on the shoulder and watch them freak out. And he said that they actually asked him not to come back anymore. And last but not least, you can have lunch at Leatherface's house. The original location uses the house of Leatherface and his family was located in Williamson County, Texas, which is now the Round Rock area. The house isn't there anymore, but if you head west of Austin into Kingsland, you can find the actual home, restored now and in use as a restaurant. And it's called the Grand Central Cafe. And they almost probably include its cinematic heritage on their website, but you will not find any human bones as part of the decor. So I thought all of those were really interesting things about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because if you watched it as many times as I have, you think you know everything about it already. But I did not know, I knew that you could go there and eat lunch at the restaurant, but all those other things, I had no idea about any of those. So this was super interesting to me. So next, because we're still celebrating Brad, and let me tell you a little something about Brad. Brad hates feet. He hates them. They disgust him. So I thought I would end our little time with Brad with a story about feet. Now, if you're a regular listener, you already know I'm a nurse, been a nurse for a long time. So this is one of my nursing stories, and this one's just for you, Brad. So this has probably been about 3 or 4 years ago, and it's actually quite a sad story, but it's also disgusting. We had a patient that their house had deteriorated so badly that they could not get back into the house, could not get up the steps to get in the house. So they had started living in the shed behind their house, which is, I mean, it breaks my heart. And if you knew the connection that this patient and I had, I did so much for them, not just because they were my patient, but this patient also did not have any family, like literally none. They had a court-appointed guardian. So basically a lawyer that had no idea anything about them was over him and in charge of his care and in charge of his money, but did not live local to him. And so it was just a bad scenario all the way around. But while this patient was living in the shed, they were also diabetic. Now, if you're familiar with anyone that's diabetic, they have a lot of trouble with their feet in general because they do not have adequate circulation to their legs and feet. So when you're living in the shed and you have no electricity, you have no running water, caring for yourself is a bit of a chore. So long story short, this patient ended up getting gangrene in their feet, not foot, both feet. This patient actually got to where they could no longer walk, and that is how they got around town. They would go to anywhere, you know, the store or the post office or anything like that, they would walk. So that's actually how they found out that this patient needed help, was because local businesses that saw him regularly, probably daily, called and reported that they had not seen him. So they went out to his house to check and found him in, you know, this condition. So the patient was sent to the hospital, was there for quite some time, and the decision was made. He was very, I'm going to get better, you know. Even though they basically told him that if you don't have your feet cut off, you're not going to live because they're not going to get better. But he didn't want to hear that, and he was not going to let them cut his feet off, period. End of story. So he was sent to a long-term care facility, and he was placed on hospice because the only thing that was going to happen eventually was death, you know. So I don't know if you're familiar with gangrene, but it will eat anything, pretty much. And the smell is horrific. It smells like something, well, it is dead. The tissue is dead and or dying, so it smells like something is dead. So the way that his feet were, have you ever seen gloves that go on your hands? Well, the skin on his feet, it had cracked all the way around, just like right above his ankle. So essentially, the skin on his feet were like socks. You had to be very careful when you were messing with his feet, doing any treatments, changing the bandage, cleaning them, because the skin on his feet would pull off like a glove, but it would have essentially been his foot. The skin was not attached at this point. So it had pulled away from all of the muscle and the tissue, and it was just dead skin was his whole foot, like a sock, and it drained horribly, as you can imagine. And luckily, he was a diabetic, and like I said, you don't have a lot of feeling in your lower extremities due to circulation, so he was not in a lot of pain. So that was a blessing. But he, his wounds, you had to be very careful when you were changing the bandage, because you had to literally take one hand and hold the skin on his foot and try to clean and bandage with the other hand. This male was bad. And he was probably one of the sweetest people that I've ever met. And he was very, very precious. And he felt bad. It was not me, but there was another nurse that worked at the facility that he was in, and she was pregnant. And so every time, she was the treatment nurse, which means that she was the one that was doing his bandages and things every day. And a lot of times the smell would make her sick. And he felt really bad about that. So it was a lot of, like I said, this is very, really a sad story, you know. But I felt like Brad would love to hear about the foot gloves that I have taken care of at one time. And he did, the patient did eventually pass away. Yeah, it was a bad deal, and it still makes me sad to think about it, because I just loved him. He was just precious to me. But anyway, so that is my story about the foot gloves. So I guess we're getting close to the end for the day, or the night, I guess. We're in the night. Let's see. If you want to email us, you can email us at dntpublishing20@gmail.com, or you can visit us on our website at dntpublishing.com. The and is spelled out on both of those. If you join us next week, we're going to be talking to author Brian Smith and see what he has going on, what he wants to tell us about. And I hope you've enjoyed the episode. We love you, Brad. We thank you for all you do for the indie horror community. You're amazing. We wouldn't be where we are without you. We wouldn't know what to do without you. You're always the biggest cheerleader, always giving everybody shout-outs and praise, and it's appreciated. You're very appreciated, and I just wanted to say thank you. And all right, I hope everyone has a wonderful night, and we will see you next week. Until then, stay scared.